The Star Tribune's holiday cookie contest is a coveted bake-off in Minnesota, and over 15 years, it's become a tradition where only the finest cookies rise to the top. All the winning recipes are neatly categorized in a new book. Think drop cookies, cutout cookies, refrigerator cookies, rolled cookies. We're talking the best cookies Minnesota has to offer to Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The contest sends many Minnesota bakers to the kitchen to experiment and fine-tune months before the October deadline. Lee Svitak-Dean is a longtime food editor at the Star Tribune, which has won multiple James Beard Awards, an Emmy, and been recognition as Best Food Section from the Association of Food Journalists. She's the author of Come One, Come All, Easy Entertaining with Seasonal Menus, and she's also co-authored The Great Minnesota Cookie Book with Rick Nelson. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, the recipes in this book have been cultivated from years of your holiday cookie contest. Tell us a little bit about how this got started, because I feel like hot dishes are being slighted here.
Well, Minnesotans have a sweet tooth, and I believe Wisconsin folks do too. But, you know, in the food sections, there are seasonal stories that always pop up that that demand a certain type of story by the readers. So when July comes around, for example, people want grilling recipes and picnic recipes, and Thanksgiving it's the turkey and leftovers. But once December rolls around on the calendar, people are focused on cookies. And even people who, you know, don't take out a mixer any other time of the year are interested in it. And one year, 16 years ago, we were sitting around the table, the food staff, trying to figure out what would be a new, for us, approach to the perennial story on cookies. And my colleague Rick Nelson, who was a new staff person at the time, said, you know, maybe we should do a contest. It was something that the food section had done in the years past. Nothing on the scale that we were planning. And we said, sure, it would be a great way to give it a try. And we really thought that it was going to be a one-time event only. And we were, you know, so surprised by the great response that we had that we tried it a second year and then a third year. And before you knew it, this was our holiday tradition, working on this project. So
people come out of the woodwork for this contest. You get hundreds of recipes. Is that right?
We do. That is right. We have 300 or more entries every year. And it's always kind of funny because people who are entering contests are not so different from reporters in the sense that they need the deadline to prompt, you know, the final entry being sent into us, and we give people about 4 or 5 weeks to submit their recipes, and then we sweat it out for like 3.5 weeks because there'll be no entries at all, and then like the day before the deadline, we are inundated with everyone's recipes. So
everyone has a little bit of a procrastination streak there.
Exactly. Yes.
Lee, what does baking do for us? What kind of opportunities does it provide?
You know, I for us, we think of it, Rick and I think of it as sort of a gateway into the kitchen, and definitely into other baking modes. I think many of us have really fun memories of baking with somebody else, whether it's a family member or friends or whatever. And the one of the charming things I think about cookies in particular is that there's not a lot of things that can go wrong with a cookie. You know, you follow the directions, you put it in the oven, and sort of like leaving something out or burning the cookie, you've got something good to eat, and it just sort of reinforces and gives people a little more confidence, I think, and in the whole process. And so we just want people to get back into the kitchen. So
Lee Svitek-Dean is a longtime food editor at the Star Tribune, which has won multiple James Beard Awards, and she is co-author of the Great Minnesota Cookie Book. Have you ever submitted a cookie recipe for a holiday cookie contest? What was the result? And perhaps more importantly, what was that recipe? What is your favorite holiday cookie and why? 800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Lee, I laughed out loud when you talked about running this cookie contest and that once the winners come out, you have a run on very specialized ingredients at area grocery stores.
Well, and this is one of the ways that we gauged also the popularity of the contest. What we discovered is that people really wait for the winning recipes, and then they get together with their, you know, family and friends to make all of them, and there's a whole lot of people doing that, and we've had several occasions where we've had more specialized ingredients. One recipe that comes to mind is an almond cookie that used almond meal, and Rick was out looking for was going to make the cookies for some event, and went out to buy the almond meal, and he went to multiple stores all over town, couldn't find any almond meal anywhere, and then called the Super Value distributor of this product to find out what the delay was.
And got to the bottom of it.
Yes, they were shocked to find out, oh, you are the person why there's not like a grain of almond flour anywhere in town. And the same thing has happened for other ingredients. We had some sliced almonds that were used in a bar, and only one place in town sold them super, super cheap. And we had contacted these folks about something, and once again they said, oh, you know, you're putting our kids through college on the sales of these almonds. Anyways, yes, very... people rush to the store.
Lee, who judges the contest, and how are winners selected?
You know, in the past, in the early years, we had our colleagues help us. They would help us test the recipes, and then they would have a voice at the judging table as well. And I'd say, like, for about the past 5 years or so, we moved over to using a pastry chef who had volunteered to help us. And she and her culinary students and fellow bakers bake all the cookies off the morning of our judging. And we felt like it really gave everybody an equal opportunity to shine when we're tasting everything fresh at the same moment. And the way people get the recipes become finalists is Rick and I go through all the entries just by looking at them, looking for recipes that are either new to us or definitely new to the contest. We don't want recipes that have won in the past or things that are similar, for example.
And we have several recipes for you at WPR.org from this book. Click on the morning show. Let your eye get drawn to that cookie cutter image. We have the recipe posted for the 2014 winner, Italian almond cookies. We have Devil's Delight cookies that took top honors in 2005. And those almond palmiers were in a runner-up in 2011. Talking about all of them with Lee Svitek-Dean, who stays with us from the Star Tribune. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you have a trendy ingredient or a tried-and-true recipe? Join us. Let's talk about it here on the Ideas Network. The panel of judges for the Star Tribune's annual holiday cookie contest, they must pace themselves as they sample the contenders. They take one bite of a cookie, give an immediate reaction, Milk and water are the palate cleansers. Serious business here. The new book brings together the winning recipes over the 15 years of the contest winners. We're talking about the best of the best Minnesota cookies here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Star Tribune's food editor, Lee Svitek-Dean, stays with us. She's co-author of the Great Minnesota Cookie Book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever submitted a cookie recipe for a holiday cookie contest? And what was the end result? Perhaps more importantly, what was that recipe? What is your favorite holiday cookware? Do you have kitchen bakeware that is absolutely essential to you? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Lee, typically a cookie has, as you say, starts with the same basic four ingredients. You have the flour, the butter, the sugar, the eggs. What are you looking for in a cookie when they get entered in a cookie contest? How do they enhance that? Where do they take it to the next level?
You know, oftentimes it's the extra ingredients or maybe a different technique that's of interest. This year for our contest, for example, the grand prize winner was a recipe that used figs, and that was an ingredient we've never come across, oddly enough, in all our years, and that kind of intrigued us. And they also had a different for us technique, which was making a cookie that was not all that different from a Fig Newton kind of style with dough wrapped around the filling, and it was really much better than the commercial version. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's the story behind the cookie. Also, I should note, we're newspaper people. We love stories, and there are times that we always ask people to provide a story behind their cookie when they enter the recipe. But sometimes as we're looking through things, stories are so compelling that we just have to try a recipe. And then if the recipe still has to rise to the top for how good it is. But sometimes the story itself does it. And
How do food trends like sea salt or brown butter show up in cookies over time, and how do you handle the trends?
You know, what's been really interesting in the contest over 15 years is that in the very early days of it, people tended to submit recipes that were much more like family favorites from grandma's kitchen. It was very traditional recipes. And then as time went on and people became more competitive, they started creating their own recipes for this contest in particular. And then they would often tap into food trends that you see in restaurants and just in general home cooking as well. And they would incorporate those into the cookies that they were developing. And so it was really interesting because there would be like a year when we would get many, many cookies that used bacon, for example, and then espresso powder was another biggie. We've had more recently. It's been
kale,
brown butter, and kale popped up a couple years ago, and we were so astounded because it wasn't just like one recipe; it was multiple recipes that we got. And in this case, it just sort of piqued our interest. It was like, well, multiple people doing this. Somebody's eating these. Let's just give it a try. And we did indeed try it, and kale cookies, I have to say, turn a very weirdly green color. And really, we decided nobody should be using kale in cookies. Leafy greens don't belong there. So
let's turn to a recipe from a baker in St. Paul. What is the story behind the almond palmiers?
Oh, yes. So this is an example of how people are creating their own. In this case, the woman who developed it had an affection for a particular palmier cookie that she got at a bakery and realized that she was spending way too much money buying these at the bakery and decided to try to create it at home. And so that's what she did. And this particular cookie, she used frozen puff pastry, which is a pretty easy product to do rather than starting from scratch and making your own.
Yeah, I was really excited to see that. I said, oh, wow, that's accessible. That, you know, that won't be a stumbling block.
and basically rolling it out using a layer of almond paste and then rolling it up again, and it creates this absolutely beautiful cookie, you know, swirly cookie that everybody thinks, you know, you must have spent hours and hours or been really like an expert to do this. And actually it takes a few minutes. That's it. It's really beautiful. So,
and what about the taste?
You buy that at a tube in the grocery store. So.
And the outcome, like, how does it taste? Do you really you feel that almond, or does the almond come out in the cookie, or is it more subtle?
Oh, yeah. I would say it's a little more subtle, but it definitely has that sort of almondy flavor that we associate with Christmas and winter stuff. So, yeah.
What cookies are part of your holiday baking tradition?
You know, there's been several cookies that I've really gotten attached to that are past winners at the paper. I don't have a really strong sweet tooth. I like things that are just not incredibly too sweet. And we had a winner a couple of years ago that used cranberries. It's called cranberry cornmeal shortbread. And it used dried cranberries, actually some rosemary as well, orange zest, and it's absolutely the most fabulous recipe. really good. And then, you know, I do have a traditional recipe as well that I go to. Again, not overly sweet. It's those Russian tea cakes, those little balls, little snowballs of ground up nuts and powdered sugar, and that's another a cookie that always makes it on my Christmas platter.
So. They pair so well with coffee or tea.
I know.
So nice.
And it's so funny to me. It's a cookie that's only served in December when around the holidays, because that's the only time my family ever had them. And I was talking with somebody who, during the summer, who'd been served these Russian tea cakes like in July, and it struck me as so odd. Oh my goodness, you know, people actually serve these 11 other months of the year. But
Lee, is there anything in your kitchen that you feel is really essential in terms of bakeware?
You know, I would say parchment paper. It makes cleanup significantly easier. You also want some good cookie sheets. You don't want rims basically on them. It makes it easier if it's just a flat surface. And
you don't want my brown and crusty bake sheets, apparently.
You might want to get some new ones every few years or something.
This interview would not be complete without talking about chocolate. So, with that said, is there anything new and different being done with chocolate these days in holiday cookies?
You know, we have one cookie that has an interesting mix of chocolate and chili peppers. That it's a cookie that won our grand prize one year called Devil's Delight Cookies, and it was based on a truffle that the baker had, and she wanted to see if she could create a cookie with the same flavors. And it has lots of cinnamon and just a tiny bit of this, you know, chili pepper in it, and it's a really interesting pairing and smells wonderful in your kitchen, and is well worth giving it a try for the holiday. So,
well, Lee, on a final note here, after you have compiled this whole cookie cookbook, do you ever get surprised by cookies? I mean, is there something that you come across and you're like, I would have never thought that pairing of flavors and texture could go together?
Yes, we are continually surprised. And I have to say that one of the things that has surprised us over the years is we thought at some point we would simply run out of cookies to try. And people keep coming up with something new, with contemporary flavors or looks. And I would say we are surprised all that. We are surprised all the time. The fig cookie really surprised us this year. Mm. And there have been others in the past that have been far more successful than the kale cookie.
Well, we'll leave it at kale cookie. Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Lee Svitek-Dean is a longtime food editor at the Star Tribune, co-author of the Great Minnesota Cookie Book. By the way, we have a bunch of recipes. WPR.org. You can check out the Italian almond cookies. We have those Devil's Delight cookie recipe as well that won top honors in 2005, as well as those almond palmiers. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. The first legal action has come down on the sweeping legislation from the lame duck legislation that Governor Walker signed into law last week. We're talking about a motion filed Monday to overturn limits to early voting. The changes approved by Governor Walker would limit early voting in Wisconsin to 2 weeks before Election Day. Let's look at the law and the policy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Robert Yablon will help us do that. He is an assistant professor in the UW Law School and a faculty affiliate with the university's Elections Research Center. Robert, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So how did we get here in the first place? What changes did lawmakers make that provoked this lawsuit Monday?
Sure. Well, as part of this lame duck legislation that the legislature passed earlier this month and that Governor Walker signed into law on Friday, there are a few provisions that deal specifically with the voting process. The one that has gotten the most attention related to this lawsuit is a rollback in early voting. And so this law prevents municipalities from allowing early voting before 2 weeks prior to the election. And for the past couple of elections, 2018, 2016, many municipalities started the early voting process before that. So that's the one that's gotten the biggest headlines. There is also some content in these bills involving the process for getting voter IDs. The ID petition process wrote some provisions into statute that had previously just been regulatory and made it a little bit harder to use a temporary ID to vote. And so that's also been a part of the challenge that that was brought earlier this week.
So what are the arguments for limiting early voting?
Well, the argument, there really wasn't that much given in terms of argument during the lame duck session. You know, this was a bill that was proposed and passed very quickly with fairly limited debate. The one argument that you heard was that this is actually in the interest of fairness, because as it stands now, municipalities, local clerks have the option to offer early voting. And some, including in Madison and Milwaukee, were offering early voting on quite generous terms. And so voting in Madison and Milwaukee started in the 2018 election as early as late September. And some smaller municipalities don't offer as much early voting. The local clerks may not feel like they have the resources to do that. And so the thinking is that it is unfair to allow folks in these bigger cities to vote earlier while not allowing it, while it doesn't happen that way in some smaller places.
So really trying to make it uniform, make early voting uniform across the state.
So that's how the argument is made, but this law actually does not create uniformity. It it shortens the window to 14 days, but it doesn't require local clerks to make early voting available during the entirety of those 14 days. So different municipalities still can choose their own schedules. It's just that they now are more limited in when the starting time will be, and they still will have their own discretion to choose their hours. And so, you know, it reduces, in a sense, you know, maybe one disparity in terms of length, but it doesn't produce true uniformity.
So that brings us to this week. Two groups with the support of the National Redistricting Foundation, which is headed by former Obama Attorney General Eric Holder, they're officially challenging this move. What's at the heart of this challenge?
So this challenge, just to be clear, is not a new lawsuit. It is the first legal action that we've seen in the wake of the governor's decision on Friday to sign this legislation. But it is part of an existing lawsuit. And so a group called One Wisconsin Institute is a lead plaintiff in litigation that was filed in federal district court here in 2015, challenging a host of voter restrictions that had been put in place in Wisconsin since 2011, including aspects of the voter ID law, early voting restrictions, and more. And in 2016, the federal district court judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs on some of their claims, but not others. And part of that ruling in favor of the plaintiffs said that some restrictions on early voting, some restrictions on getting voter IDs were unconstitutional. And what the litigants are doing now is they are arguing that this new legislation is contrary to the judge's existing ruling. And so they're asking the judge by motion to enforce the existing ruling by disallowing these new laws to take effect.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost deja vu here. District Judge James Peterson wrote in 2016, rather than working to expand early voting in smaller communities, the state limited it in large ones. He rejected the fairness argument in 2016. So it feels like there's some precedent here.
It does. And so the fairness arguments that you heard this time around are very similar to the ones that the court considered in 2016 and rejected, did not find convincing at that time. There are some slight differences with what the legislature passed now and what was in place before. So immediately before the court's ruling, early voting had been dialed all the way back to 10 days. And there had been no weekend voting allowed, the hours had been regulated. And so now you have 14 days, although really that's only 13 days of potential early voting because there's no early voting the Monday before the election. So it's a day or two longer. They've lifted the restrictions on weekend voting and they've lifted some of the hours restrictions. So it's marginally more generous than what the court considered previously, but a lot less than what had been offered in 2016 and 2018.
We're talking with Robert Yablon, who is an assistant professor in the University of Wisconsin Law School, talking about a legal motion filed this week challenging the legislation Governor Walker signed into law last week that puts more limits on early voting and some other restrictions. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. How do you feel about limiting early voting in Wisconsin? What do you think are the arguments for and against restrictions on early voting? You can call in 800-642-1234 or tweet us, WPR Mornings. Robert, in a statement from the National Redistricting Foundation, Holder said Republicans are attempting to, quote, to suppress the votes of people of color in the state. Why is Holder making that argument? What does he see there?
So that actually grows out of part of the 2016 ruling by the federal district court. So with respect to early voting, the federal court found that it was unconstitutional, partly because it placed what the court would call an undue burden on the right to vote. But the court also held that it was unconstitutional because it was intentionally discriminatory and it violated the Voting Rights Act because it had a disparate racial effect. And the idea there is that the municipalities that seem to be targeted by these early voting cutbacks were Milwaukee in particular. And there were some statements made during the legislative debate in which legislators expressed concern that people in Milwaukee were given so many opportunities to vote. And the district court viewed that as kind of a euphemism for suppression of the African-American vote because such a large proportion of the state's African-American population is based in Milwaukee. So by reducing voting in Milwaukee, the idea is that you are, in effect, making it more difficult for African Americans and Latino citizens to vote.
So how would Judge Peterson perhaps evaluate this claim? You know, what could the judge do there?
Well, so the judge has ruled on a very similar claim before, and so part of the work that the judge already has done will be relevant. The judge also may look to see whether during the debates specific to this legislation, the lame duck during the lame duck session, there were similar sentiments expressed. You know, were the reasons given the same as the reasons that were given before, or have they articulated some new rationale for putting in place these early voting restrictions?
Why has Holder's group really been focused on election-related law in Wisconsin?
So Holders Group initially formed as an organization that was primarily focused on gerrymandering. And Wisconsin, of course, has been in the news because we have had litigation related to our state legislative districts, which were drawn after the 2010 census by partisan actors with the idea of trying to keep themselves in power. And so his group has been focused on Wisconsin initially for that reason, and then I think has remained engaged with the state because this is such a purple state in which elections are always up for grabs, and I think that he and his group want to make sure that the voting process in Wisconsin is fair as they see it.
How does Wisconsin compare to other states in the area of early voting?
There is a lot of variation across the country on early voting. Most states do offer at least some. I think we're talking at least 3/4 of the states that do have some early voting. And they vary widely in terms of the length of time in which it's offered. So there are some states that will offer 40-plus days, 6 weeks or so of early voting. A few states where the number is as little as maybe 4 or 5 days. I read one study that suggested that the average length of time among states for early voting is about 22 days. So in municipalities like Madison and Milwaukee, we might have been slightly above that average in 2016 and 2018. This new legislation will put us somewhat below that average.
Let's go to Chris now, joining us from Green Bay with a question. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thank you very much. So I heard a lot of talk before the bill was passed that this bill could separate the elections in 2020, separating the general election and then the election for Supreme Court. Did that part of the bill pass or go through?
Thanks for the question. Go ahead.
That was discussed and considered during the legislative process, but ultimately that was not part of the bill that was passed. They did not change the dates of the presidential primary or the 2020 state Supreme Court election.
What implications would this have on 2020?
The specific provisions being challenged here. It's hard to say exactly what the practical implications are. I mean, if we look at who was using the early voting mechanisms these past couple of elections, a lot of people in Wisconsin vote early. So there were over 500,000 early votes cast in the 2018 election.
565,000.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in Dane County, I believe it was over 80,000 early votes. In Milwaukee County, I believe it was over 90,000. And I think that the litigants in this new lawsuit have tried to look at how many of those folks were voting more than 2 weeks ahead of time. And there in both Dane County and Milwaukee County, the numbers were 20,000 plus in each county. And so those voters will have to vote differently next time. I think that you can't say that those are votes that won't be cast. I mean, maybe some of those people will be unable to get to the polls at all, but they'll have to shift their voting behavior. And then there's this other part of the legislation involving voter IDs and the petition process, and that may also change the way people vote.
And we're going to get to that here in just a moment, talking with Robert Yablon as our guide, assistant professor at the UW Law School, getting your thoughts on early voting, voting restrictions, 800-642-1234. Does it even the playing field for communities across the state with different rules on early voting, or is it an attempt to suppress votes? How will the case turn out? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. In the November election, the cities of Madison and Milwaukee allowed for early voting 6 weeks prior to Election Day, whereas smaller communities around the state had a more limited window. In all, more than 565,000 people voted early, the most for a midterm election in state history. We're looking at the lawsuit challenging early voting restrictions and how it might play out. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW Law School's Robert Yablon stays with us as we look at the legal framework. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching this case? What do you think about Wisconsin's voting rules as a whole? You can call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Robert, let's get into more of the lesser publicized, perhaps, aspects of this legislation and what it would do specifically in the area of voter IDs.
Sure. So the early voting rollbacks are going to be the most visible voting-related part of this legislation. But something else that this legislation did is it codified some regulations that had been in place from the Department of Transportation, which regulated how people get voter IDs, their free voter IDs, when they're unable otherwise to get a qualifying voter ID card. And so the state has had in place something called the ID petition process. And it's supposed to be a safety valve for people who otherwise have difficulty getting ID cards, maybe because their birth certificate is hard to find. Maybe they have some of their underlying documents, but there are some minor discrepancies between those documents and other government documents. You know, the spelling of their name on their birth certificate is slightly different from on other government documents. And so the state has a petition and has a process in place where they can petition and try to get an ID anyway. And so what this legislation did is it codified that into statute. And one implication of that is it means that the incoming governor won't, by regulation, be able to change the way that this process works and perhaps make it more generous, make it somewhat easier for people to qualify for these free IDs. And beyond that, what this new legislation does is it reduces the amount of time that your temporary once you enter this petition process, you get essentially a temporary ID that you can use for voting, and it reduces the amount of time that those temporary IDs are good for. And so folks who got one of those temporary IDs, one of these certificates that allowed them to vote in the 2018 election, it's going to have it now expired by the time we get to the spring 2019 elections.
Oh, so by April 2nd, it will have expired.
Right. So under the new legislation, it's only good for a 60-day window until you go through this whole petition process and either are given your ID or not. But the district court judge in its 2016 order explicitly lengthened the amount of time that these temporary certificates would be good for and said that because there were some flaws in the ID petition process, that increased amount of time that you could use a temporary ID was kind of a necessary remedial measure. And that's been rolled back as part of this law.
Well, Diane from Iron County called in, couldn't stay with us, and says, our DMV isn't open except for a very limited time. Why aren't they trying to ease access to the DMV in rural areas? What is the gateway for DMVs?
So, you know, this is an issue that DMVs in different part of the state have different hours. And so when you have a voter ID requirement in place, you are basically enlisting the Department of Transportation, the Department of Motor Vehicles to help you administer your elections. And so, you know, one issue then is you want to make sure that those offices are sufficiently accessible. And sometimes the hours in particular communities are limited.
Let's go to Marianne now, joining us from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning. I have several questions, and this is based on Senator Nygren's comments at Joint Finance, as he spearheaded much of this in terms of the number of the early voting. There are town clerks and there are city clerks throughout the state. Those clerks are there part-time, many of them full-time. I don't understand why those clerks could not open up to early voting in the smaller communities. You come in a small community like Sturgeon Bay, you come into town, you do your shopping, you go to the city clerk, and you vote early. So I'm puzzled by that. Also, with regard to the open, providing the early voting in larger cities, when you have low-income people who are working two and three jobs at minimum wage, and you restrict the voting for them, you make it even more economically and socially difficult for them to meet their voter obligation. So I do see this as discrimination.
Marianne, thanks for the call. Can we start with clerks?
Sure. Well, then actually both of the caller's comments echo a couple of points that the district court judge made in his 2016 opinion. So first, the district court judge said, to the extent that there are these disparities and that some localities are offering more generous early voting than others, then what the state's focus ought to be is on making early voting more generous uniformly rather than cutting it back in the places that are more generous. And so it's true that there are local clerks who might be able, without too much of an additional expenditure of resources, resources to make early voting something that's more available. Now, it's also true that some of the larger municipalities have longer voting hours, you know, the 11 hours a day, and that might not be something that all small local clerks are able to offer. But the district court's intuition was we should be trying to make early voting more generous rather than less. And then the caller also points to another difference between some of the large communities and small communities that the district court identified, which is that there are some barriers to access in that more people experience in some large communities like Milwaukee and Madison in terms of working multiple jobs with less flexible schedules, in terms of not having access to a car or reliable transportation. And so the thinking was that having more generous early voting actually is a way to help even the playing field in those communities rather than make it unfair.
So we have this legislation. Governor Walker signed it. A lot of other other pieces of that bill include a move by the legislature to limit some powers of incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers and the incoming Democratic Attorney General Josh Call. Do you expect to see legal challenges to other changes as well?
I suspect so. I think that some of those incoming officials have signaled that we should expect to see more litigation. There were a lot of controversial components to these lame duck bills beyond these voting provisions that we've been talking about. And so this filing that we saw on Monday, I suspect, is just the first of probably a number of different legal challenges that we'll see in the weeks and months to come.
So after the Monday filing, what happens next with Judge Peterson, and what is the show us the legal process that is to come?
Sure. So, Judge, I believe that now the state will respond to this motion. And what I've read is that their response is due just after New Year's, which is somewhat interesting timing. It means that the current Department of Justice will be responsible for filing the response, you know, just before the new attorney general takes over. The new attorney general, interestingly, was part of this lawsuit working on behalf of the plaintiffs, trying to fight these voting restrictions on early voting. I believe that he said that he, as a result, would now recuse himself when he comes in. But by the time this motion gets argued in front of Judge Peterson, it's likely that you are going to have sort of a new Department of Justice involved. So the plaintiffs have asked for relief soon. They want to get this resolved in late winter, early spring, because we do have some elections coming up. The next general election in Wisconsin is going to be in April 2019. And so I suspect that we'll have a hearing in January or February, and Judge Peterson will try to make a ruling soon. The one wrinkle is that Judge Peterson's 2016 ruling actually remains under review in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And so the Seventh Circuit could throw a wrench in this. It's been holding on to that case now for almost 2 years, which is an unusually long time to hold on to it. And once they issue their decision, that actually becomes the operative legal ruling rather than the 2016 ruling that Judge Peterson has already entered.
Very interesting and complicated string of events there. We'll be watching. Thank you so much for joining us, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Yablon is an assistant professor in the University of Wisconsin Law School and a faculty affiliate with the university's Elections Research Center. We've been looking at that legislation that has some limiting impact on early voting and other things as well. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.